This is Colorado Matters from Colorado Public Radio. I'm Ryan Warner. The president unveiled his budget plan this week and wants to cut defense by $100 billion. That's likely to result in a lot of theatrics, says Gordon Adams, defense analyst and Shakespearean actor. Adams is a professor of international relations at American University. He's been named one of the most influential people in U.S. defense, and he held a senior national security position in the Clinton White House. He's also an accomplished thespian. And as he told CPR's Elaine Grant, he's connecting these two passions this week in Boulder at the Conference on World Affairs.
Since I live in Washington, which we like to call Hollywood for ugly people, mostly people are doing a lot of backstabbing and a lot of indirection and a lot of appearances. And, you know, there isn't a play in Shakespeare or a line in Shakespeare that doesn't somehow relate to politics. We'll all end up as King Lear at the end wondering why we didn't pick the right daughter to begin with.
You are a military budget expert. How Shakespearean will the battle over military spending be?
Well, it will be full of sound and fury signifying nothing, as Macbeth said. We've had this for 2 years now. We've literally had the most wonderful, I call it an Indonesian shadow play. That's an Indonesian form of theater where two-dimensional puppets are manipulated, their arms and legs on sticks behind a backlit curtain. And the audience in front thinks they're real and something's happening. So for the last 2 years, we've had what I call the Indonesian shadow play of the federal budget, where everybody set up possibilities of resolution only to bat them down, where commissions were created that were designed to fail, where electoral contests were fought out, where people vigorously argued that the national security was going to disappear down the toilet if we didn't get the defense budget exempt from this thing called sequester, right up until March 1, when the budget sequester piece went into effect. The last round was totally Shakespearean, total Armageddon, doomsday, national security will disappear. Secretary Panetta said we'll become a second-rate power, literally full of sound and fury signifying nothing, because now we're in the world of sequester. It turns out it won't be quite as bad as we thought it was, and people are going to be furloughed, yes, and that's not great, but in the Defense Department it won't be 22 days, it'll be 14 days. The rhetoric is all toned down, and then we bring in, you know, a new counselor to the king, Chuck Hagel. The new Secretary of Defense, right? And he comes in and says, you know, we'll manage through this. Just cool your jets. We'll work on it. We'll be okay. You know, we'll have to do some serious choice making. You know, in the end, having lived and worked in Washington for 30 years, you could virtually predict exactly how this drama was going to go. You know, after a while, cynicism is just sort of realism with a sigh.
You've argued that cutting the Pentagon's budget is important for reducing the deficit, and that's a pretty tough sell in Washington. How realistic is it?
Totally realistic. What's interesting is we've gone through this before. Three times before, we have seen the defense budget go up and come down after Korea, after Vietnam, after the end of the Cold War. And in average dollar terms, the defense budget from its peak in each of those episodes to 10 years out, went down 30% in constant dollars. That is, when you take the inflation out and measure it in real money. So we've done this three times before. That's one of the things that's perfectly predictable here. We knew that this was going to happen. And I've been saying for 4 years now to the Pentagon, we're in a drawdown. The money is coming down. Get used to it. You know, get over the Sturm und Drang and the theater of trying to prevent this from happening and start planning for it, because it is going to happen. And the reason it happens is really clear, and it's very simple. It's because we get out of a war. Public attention shifts away from defense. We start to worry about other things like debts and deficits and the economy and jobs. And defense, like any other form of federal spending, becomes, if you will, a drive-by victim of that shift in public attention. We literally are now entering a period where that will happen. And what's really fascinating about it is that although you think it's a hard sell in Washington, we have this myth. You know, this is all about theater. We have this myth that the Republicans love defense and the Democrats hate it, and that therefore the Republicans will always defend it and the Democrats will always sell it out. The reality politically is that every prior defense drawdown we've done has been done under a Republican president. Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, George H.W. Bush, each of them oversaw this mammoth decline in defense budgets, and they were Republican presidents. We now have a Democratic president, which oddly enough might make it slightly different because the myth says Democrats have to show they're tough on defense because people believe they're weak on defense. But the reality is now in the Congress, the Republican Party is split. The Tea Party group and a substantial part of the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives are telling the leadership defense goes along with the rest of it. It can come down. There's a lot of waste there. It should come down. We're going to let it come down, which means that the Republican Party is divided. They're not going to stand up and say, you know, defense, man the barricades, hold the line. Not happening. It's clearly not. The defense budget's already down 10% in constant dollars since it peaked in 2010. It's going to go down another 10% because of the impact of sequester this year. And it will be continue to be on a downslope because conditions have changed. So the interesting reality here is it's happening.
It's happening, although there's certainly a lot of outcry. Nobody wants base closures in their own backyard. There are still defense hawks saying we have to be the strongest military in the world. How can you do this? What's your response to that?
Right. The reality is nobody's listening to them. Last year, the Aerospace Industries Association, which is one of the trade associations for the defense contracting businesses, and Senator John McCain and Senator Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire and Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, all three of them political forces to be reckoned with, they put together a multi-million dollar campaign during the election saying exactly what you're saying. Got to protect defense, can't bring it down, going to cost a million jobs, don't sacrifice anything, our national security is going to be handicapped. They went out and did this in nine states. Eight of them were carried by Barack Obama. It simply was not being heard. And the reason is most of the public, they're focused on other things, and defense is secondary consideration. You know, keep in mind, we have the most powerful and only global military of any country in the world. And even after a 30% cut in constant dollars, we will still have the only military that can fly anywhere, sail anywhere, deploy anywhere. It has the only global logistics and transportation and communications and intelligence of any military in the world. Nobody else is even trying, not even the Chinese, which everybody wants to make into the next boogeyman. We are so far ahead of the traffic on this that almost any variation in defense is not going to affect the global military superiority of the United States. Once you're there, the argument that we ought to spend on defense because it's going to affect local economies or particular companies is a very secondary argument. It always goes down after we get out of combat. It will go down again. And yes, communities will be affected. And yes, certain industries will be affected, but nowhere near to the extent that it's being described. So what you're watching here, again, is theater.
If you're just joining us, I'm Elaine Grant, and this is Colorado Matters from Colorado Public Radio. My guest is Gordon Adams, who was named one of the 100 most influential people in U.S. defense by Defense News this year. He's also a professional actor and a poet. Let's go back to the fact that you, Gordon, are practically the definition of a Renaissance man. One conference on world affairs panel that you're on is called How to Create, Find, or Stumble Upon Your Dream Job. You decided not that long ago that you loved theater so much that you had to get back into it. Tell me about your journey.
Did a lot of theater until I was about 30 and ended up at 30 in New York. I was going to graduate school there, and I was also working off Broadway in theater. And at that point in my life, I had to make a choice. Would I go in and become a fully trained up actor competing in the acting world and waiting on tables in the daytime? Or would I finish a PhD and, you know, go into the professional research world and be able to pay my bills? And I chose at that point to, you know, the what my dad would have called the responsible choice, which is to, you know, give up some of that creative activity and have a professional career, which I have done for 30 years and feel quite good about. But that said, about 8 or 10 years ago, I got hungry again. And it was like, I cannot satisfy myself if I don't do something for my right brain as well as my left brain. I got to get back into creative work. So I literally went back to school. I went to Studio Theater Conservatory in Washington, D.C., and have been studying. I got one course left in their program because I do it part-time. About 4 or 5 years ago, decided it was time to start auditioning, which I did. And I'm now an equity membership candidate. And I've been on stages from the Shakespeare Theater Company all the way to Silver Spring Community Theater, doing Shakespeare and contemporary drama, all kinds of parts, and I love it. It feeds my right brain, and that's a form of knowledge that we don't, we people who do policy work don't often live in that universe, and it's enormously satisfying.
You waited until relatively late in life to decide, I want to do this as a full-fledged second career.
Absolutely. I was when I decided that I wanted to do this, I was about 62 years old. And one of the really odd payoffs of waiting that long is because I'm an older male, I'm actually castable, independent of talent, which is, of course, enormous, but that's neither here nor there, because there are very few people in my age bracket who are still doing live theater. So it's fascinating. There are a lot of roles for older men, probably because a lot of theatrical literature back before the last 20 or 30 years was written by older men. That are still being produced, and therefore there's a lot of casting opportunities. So that's kind of fun. It was not for want of work.
And you most recently played Polonius in Hamlet, right?
I did, yes. And Polonius is very interesting as a character, if you think about the political world, because the usual image of Polonius on stage is this bumbling old guy that can't tie his shoelaces and gives garbled instructions to people all the time and is kind of lost and, of course, gets stabbed in the middle of the show and disappears. But in fact, if you look at the character, Polonius is your classic insider political advisor to the president. Oops, I mean the king. Who knows where everybody is buried, knows what every deal is. He listens to that meeting between Hamlet and his mother because he wants to know that it's going to go right. He's an arranger. He's a fixer. He's a classic, smart political advisor at the very senior level of the court, if not the White House, who knows where everything's going and wants to make sure that it gets there. And like too many political advisors, he blows it. In the end, he ends up paying with his life for trying to arrange things too cleverly.
Do you personally identify with that role of Polonius?
I can. You've got to be able to be whoever that character is, even if you're not that character, and you have to reach into what you've lived, who you are, where you've been. I've spent 30 years in Washington, and I know about political fixers. I can do some political fixing myself. I know how to play that game. So getting the sense of the character of Polonius as a political fixer is not that hard. Being it is the challenge. You can't just go on and recite the lines. You've got to be that person.
Gordon, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be with you. Thank you.
Defense analyst and actor Gordon Adams spoke with CPR's Elaine Grant. He's taking part in this week's Conference on World Affairs at CU Boulder. Adams is a professor of international relations at American University in Washington, D.C.